saving money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Matthew Ardell, and welcome to the Comedy Album Book Club Holiday Special. This year, I'm sitting down with filmmaker, musician, writer, and performer Emily Milling, as well as writer and performer John Burdesky. We're going to talk about our three favorite holiday films or specials, and you couldn't get a more diverse selection than this year. Emily selected Arnold Schwarzenegger's action extravaganza, Jingle All the Way. John selected the perennial holiday favorite, A Christmas Story. And I chose The Colbert Christmas, the greatest gift of all. So pour yourself some eggnog, not forgetting the nutmeg, and sit back for this very special comedy album book club. Welcome to Comedy Album Book Club. Emily, John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
So, this year's Christmas special, we're doing Jingle All the Way, A Christmas Story, and A Colbert Christmas. So let's start with you, Emily. Why did you choose Jingle All the Way?
Oh my God. So Arnie, and also me and my partner, Justin DeClue, love watching this movie every single year. We make it a tradition. It's a tradition. This is the time of year for traditions. And so we have done that. And I'm pretty sure I got him out of like the Best Buy $5 bin. I got him the DVD and then we just couldn't stop watching it. It's such a ridiculous movie. It's such a crazy thing. And there's so many quotable moments. And like, you can't not quote Arnie.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's film Jingle All the Way was released November 16, 1996, and was a diversion from the action star Arnold Schwarzenegger's usual action movie fare into the realm of family holiday entertainment. Possibly one of his most friendly films, with the other exception being 1993's The Last Action Hero, Schwarzenegger was joined by a veritable who's who of talent in this film. Phil Hartman, Sinbad, Rita Wilson, Jim Belushi, Martin Mull, Harvey Korman, Lorraine Newman, and early performances by Chris Parnell, and young Jake Lloyd before his effectively career-ending role in The Phantom Menace. Filmed in Minneapolis and St. Paul, with scenes shot in the Mall of America before returning to California to finish filming, the film was distributed by 20th Century Fox and produced by 1492 Pictures, Christopher Columbus's production company, producing everything from Bicentennial Man to the Harry Potter saga. Directed by Brian Levant and written by Randy Cornfield, with an uncredited Chris Columbus, the film's budget is listed at between $60 and $75 million, but had a box office return of $129.8 million, before adding in decades of streaming, television, and DVD sales. The film itself had a very truncated production schedule, with Schwarzenegger as a late addition, leaving only 6.5 months for the normal marketing push. The film debuted at the Mall of America and was head-to-head against Star Trek First Contact, Space Jam, and Ransom. In its opening weekend, it took in $12.1 million. This was Phil Hartman's last film, and I suspect Jake Lloyd wishes it was his as well.
So, yeah. That's why, in a nutshell, Turbo Man is super cool.
Yeah,
Booster sucks.
It's such a crazy cast in that movie too. I mean, you have like Lorraine Newman, like you have some of the greatest comedians of a generation.
It's true.
Multiple generations.
And the mom is the lady from Now and Then who plays Chrissy grown up.
Yeah.
That's for all you Now and Then fans, which I'm sure tons of you are listening to this.
Yeah, you have like multiple SNL alum in there of mm-hmm. various years. Poor Jake Lloyd, like his one movie before his career imploded.
It's true. Such a good little actor that will go.
He was very earnest.
You know, he makes me want to cry.
It's like, I actually feel sorry for
like him and the guy who played Jar Jar, they just had their careers destroyed by one movie.
Character.
Yeah, one movie.
It's funny, like it came out, what, like 95?
96.
So like peak Arnie.
Yeah.
And everyone's just like, kind of like feels like The Rock. Like everyone's just like,
yes.
Whatever he's in, I don't even care.
And it was,
I just want to get in it.
He joined
like the shiny thing.
He joined the production with like 6 months before the release. So like he was really cast late in the production. So they made a limited run of 200,000 Turbo Man toys.
Wow.
And it's really hard to get your hands on though.
Yeah. Well, apparently, like it was like some super limited run, but I mean that Wintertainment parade, is so over the
top.
It's
so far fetched, so unreasonable, and the jetpack suit. Do you remember that part where
I don't
just like so like they put him. He's like running around. He's trying to impress his son and get him this Turbo Man doll, and then he finally like runs away from a cop that he's been like physically hurting the entire movie, and so he runs away into this like warehouse area, and they start suiting him up in a Turbo Man suit, and they're like, "Oh, we fixed the jetpack thruster on this guy. Sorry about the other guy. It was a terrible accident, but you'll be fine." And then he's like, "What am I doing?" And then he realizes he's Turbo Man in this parade,
right.
And he's like, "I have to give this doll to my son," and the guy, I can't remember the bad guy's name, but what's his name that plays the mailman?
Sinbad.
Yeah. Sinbad, who plays the mailman.
You know,
is
it's
like
quality entertainment when Sinbad is the bad guy.
He's like hellbent on also getting it for his son because they're both competing for their son's love with each other. It's ridiculous. And so then, so he dresses up as the bad guy. And then Arnie has to save his son from the bad guy with this jetpack thing, and they're flying all over the place straight through people's houses. It's insane. It's insanity. It's so much entertaining fun.
So much entertainment.
I love it.
It's like nothing like a little bit of light, you know, kidnapping and child endangerment for a holiday movie.
Just hijinks.
Yeah. And there's a couple things that really amaze me about this movie. The first being they found somebody bigger than Arnold Schwarzenegger. He is a tall man, as well as a strong man, and they found somebody who's good, like foot taller than him, and like not with weird proportions, but like stacked like he is as mm-hmm. well. That was astounding. Like, I'm like, how do you find that? Like, that guy's got to be like 7 foot.
You know? You walk into a gym, I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, Arnold, do you have any big friends? Oh, let me check my Rolodex.
Invite your muscle man friends over.
And it's this. It's for family fun. It is a hyper violent movie.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So
but so is Kindergarten Cop.
Yes. Yes. But I mean, it feels like right before this, he did Last Action Hero, but that feels like a pivot point in his career where he's trying to get away from the more action stuff. And like, I think already by this point, he's probably planning his gubernatorial run. So he's like, I got to make myself a little bit more family friendly, not murder machine kind of thing.
He's so goofy. I love that guy.
Yeah, I mean, he won.
He did. He wasn't that bad a governor, all said.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't have any hard stats on it, but all I remember is like a quotable quote was like, he's like, I just love cranes. Like, I love to see cranes because it means we're building.
Oh,
and I was like, yes, at its most basic form, yes, that is building.
You should come to Toronto.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the Ford family used that exact quote at some point. So they ripped off Arnold Schwarzenegger at some point. But yeah, like in this movie too, it's like it's so tonally uneven. Like it's Christopher Columbus. He's technically not credited on there, but it's his production company, and he's unlisted writer. So my guess is he fixed the script and then just didn't take a credit on it. But you've got Phil Hartman as possibly the sleaziest neighbor.
Balthazar,
ever.
No.
Oh God. And it's like but it's charming, like it's Phil Hartman at his best. So it's like, you know, like in Street Fighter when Raul Julia died immediately after that. It's like, oh, we'll never see him in a great role. His last role is M. Bison in the Street Fighter movie, and they're terrible. paws for getting the cat into the room. Get out of here, you monkey. Shoot. Oh, sorry. There we go. All right. Set in post.
Yeah, so you get, like, Raul Juliet, but this one is, like, even as bad as the rest of the movie can be at times, it does have a charm, and Phil Hartman is part of that charm.
I disagree with your statement, but go on.
But Phil Hartman is part of that charm. It's like, he's playing, like, the ultimate Phil Hartman character, this sleazy, entitled, douchey guy who thinks he's right. Like, whatever reality he lives in his mind, he's right. And he's like, oh, you know, she just doesn't understand she's into me yet, kind of thing. And it's like, it's so gross.
Well, I mean, like, that's very typical male behavior of that time.
True.
And I hope not now. Men.
Make a note. If you behave like Phil Hartman, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Truly. It's gross.
Yeah, it's just like, he's so great. And I'm trying to think. Sinbad is actually kind of fun as a really unhinged character, too.
He was more than kind of fun, okay? Like, he's great in that movie. Yeah. Everybody in this movie is off the charts, hilarious, fun, super great, all the time.
All the time.
And maybe it's because I'm watching it with my boyfriend and we're both like, ah, things that are inside jokes for us, but it's still very entertaining for us.
That opening scene in the, like, the most insane off-the-hook Christmas party in any office ever.
Yes.
And he's, like, the one guy... You got, like, people making out on the mattress, like, warehouse
floor.
It's
like the Christmas party of the Santa Claus, also.
I feel like that's every Christmas party in any movie is, like, amazing.
Yeah.
Was the Christmas party for Salesforce that amazing the other day?
It was pretty nice, but...
I mean, like, any Christmas party with a croque en bouche, you know that's going to be off the chain. I'm, like, looking at this table of food, I'm like... Pizza, croque and bouche. I'm like, I'm sorry. You don't go to a patisserie and get, like, these fancy, like, cream puff thing tower for your Christmas party.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's California. It's Minneapolis, St. Paul. Mm-hmm. But
Twin Cities. So weird.
Love
weird
a good
location.
Twin City.
Yeah. What other movies are even set there, ever?
Like, none.
I can't
think of any.
But it is frigid. And probably guaranteed to have snow whenever filming.
That's true.
So and they filmed again over a very short period of time. So they're like, okay, we got to get somewhere cheap, get in, get out. Oh, also, it has the Mall of America, which is where all the mall scenes were filmed, which is like the biggest mall in the world.
Consumerism.
Yeah.
And that's thing.
It's the whole movie.
Like, how?
What?
How hard?
Mind blown.
How hard must it have been to get the rights? Because, like, they had Disney characters. They had, like, Warner Brother characters. I haven't seen that many, like, cartoon characters, even if it is in their, like dancing form of, like, parade outfits in one movie since, like, Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It used to be, like, a fun thing when you were a kid and seeing them all in one place. And maybe someone was just like, I want that magic back, and spent far too much money on it. At least that's the story I'm telling myself.
Or like they convinced them, this is the next big Arnold movie. You give us some money, we'll put your character in this movie.
For
and that's
sure.
free advertising because everybody loves Arnie.
That's
makes
it.
A lot more sense than what I just said.
But because we want to bring it all together for the Wintertainment Festival.
Wintertainment.
I'm like, I would actually go to see that because that's just so freaking insane. And if it culminated in like an epic battle with a
truly
flight suit,
so fucking cool.
Yeah.
Can I swear on your show?
You can swear all you
fuck,
like.
Fuck, I'm so sorry.
It's fucking okay.
Great.
Yeah. So okay. So what stands out? Like it's a movie that
How do I even start saying things that stand out? Like, I like when Jake Lloyd is talking to Arnie on the phone, and he's like, where's your mother? And he's like, she's across the street petting Ted. And then he gets really mad because Ted's the name of the reindeer, but also the name of Phil Hartman's character. And I set that up really poorly, but it was really funny. That stands out to me, Ted's fight. And also Balthazar, he sets the, like, nativity scene on fire, and then he kicks Balthazar's head, like, out the flaming head out the window, and Phil Hartman's like, no, Balthazar! He gets so upset about the whole thing. God, I don't know. Yeah. And for, I really love when the cop gets, like, brutally maimed. Like, he should be dead, by all accounts. Multiple.
There was a bomb.
Like, he's exploded. Bomb. And, like, later in the day at the Winter Fun Fest Parade, what is it? The Winter...
Wintertainment Parade.
He's there, and the only thing he's got, like, some bandages wrapped around his hands, and he's holding two coffees, and then Arnie smashes into him, and he burns himself. Like, this is the only thing that's a problem for him. He just continued working that day after a bomb situation. Oh, my God. What else stands out? I really love, like, okay, so you know when you're driving on the highway and you see people, like, shooting up the side on the shoulder?
Mm-hmm.
I always assume that it's, like, someone trying to get to their kid's black belt or yellow belt presentation, because that's what Arnie does getting started in the movie. Like, he comes from his office and he's super late. You're my number one customer. And then he's driving up the shoulder of the road. That's where he meets
for people who haven't seen the movie. Everyone is his number one customer.
Yeah.
Everyone.
He says it to his wife and she gets real mad.
Good.
Yeah.
As she should.
Yes. Those are all the things I could go on, but I won't.
One of the things I kind of find endearing about the film is everything, literally everything, is dialed to 11. Like, that nativity scene, it's not just a regular nativity scene. This is full-size mannequins spread throughout the house of Ted in multiple rooms. Like, that's a crazy ass. That's an art installation. That's not a nativity scene.
Well, they jingle all the way.
All the way, baby. That's now... Our second film is sort of kind of a tonal opposite in a way.
Yep.
John, you chose A Christmas Story.
I did.
So tell us, what made you choose that?
Oh, A Christmas Story. It's so nice. And it's so, just so innocent.
A Christmas Story is for many a holiday tradition, up alongside Home Alone and National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Based on the writings of satirist Gene Parker Shepherd Jr., or Shep as his pen name, a radio broadcaster and professional satirist, Shep began his career in Cincinnati in the year 1945 before eventually landing in New York on WOR Radio. His radio career lasted until 1977, after which he made occasional appearances on NPR's All Things Considered, and in the mid-90s had a show on WBAI Radio reading his essays and stories. Shepherd, friends of Shel Silverstein, Herb Gardner, and Lois Nettleton, is known to have inspired raconteurs Spalding Gray and Garrison Keillor, as well as influencing the works of diverse creators like Jerry Seinfeld, Bill Griffith of Zippy Comic fame, as well as being featured in Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media. Given this heady list of peers, proteges, and those inspired by him, it's almost ironic that in 1983, three-time Genie Award-winning American-born Canadian director Bob Clark, whose other films include Monkey's Paw, Black Christmas, and possibly most famously Porky's, was tapped to direct the film. So once you understand the nature of Porky's, a recounting of Clark's own youth in Florida, the appeal of Shepherd's work becomes obvious. There's a stylistic similarity between the two films. Where one is a body sex romp, the other is a Rockwellian ode. The screenplay was written by Gene Shepherd, Bob Clark, and Lee Brown, and based on Shepherd's book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, the film starred Melinda Dillon, Darren McGavin, and Peter Billingsley, and was narrated by Gene Shepherd himself. The film was budgeted at $3.3 million, with the majority of exterior shots in Cleveland, and the remainder shot in St. Catharines and Toronto, Ontario. The film turned in a modest $20.6 million. The modest profit was bolstered when Turner Classic Television began airing the film in 1986, exposing it to a much wider audience, and it's now considered one of the best films of 1983, and is a holiday favorite, one of the few films Leonard Maltin has awarded 4 stars. Vaguely set in the late 1930s or early 40s, the resurgent popularity led to a 2012 sequel set specifically in 1946. Like Aunt Clara's pajamas, this is something best to be avoided, or at least not to be seen enjoying by friends.
I don't know. I just like it because it's like a simpler time, and you're like, yeah, maybe if I grew up in like the late 50s, early 60s, like things would be better. They seem better, even though they like weren't. But like, I don't know. I just love the just how simplistic everything is, and like the tropes of like just growing up in like, you know, they're in like Northern Indiana or whatever, but like it's basically like any town USA.
Yeah.
And you're just, it's everything's so relatable and tropey. It's great.
It's like Gene Shepard who wrote, or Gene Shepard Jr. who wrote the book.
Right.
It's based on, and wrote the screenplay.
Yeah. What's the name of the book again? It's got a hilarious title.
Oh.
I
did the research last night.
So did I.
Oh, In God We Trust, All Others Pay by Cash.
Yes. That is a good title.
Yeah. And it sort of sums up the Americana of this in so many ways, which is funny.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, although it's an American director, he's Canadian based.
Oh, really? I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, so it was the Bob Clark who directed Black Christmas. Mm. He's a horror director.
If only Justin Declew were here.
Yeah, he directed Monkey Paw, but most famously, he directed Porky's, which was kind of the same kind of movie in that it was, because Porky's is essentially his recounting of his life growing up, much the way this was Shepherd's recounting of his childhood. So it's like, you think it couldn't be two different movies, but from a creative point of view, it's actually kind of synchronicity.
Yeah.
And that they're using a similar story method, and Clark actually cites Shepherd as inspiration to him as a creator. But it's like, yeah, I mean, the film was filmed in Ohio, but also Toronto and St. Catharines. So the Chinese restaurant scene,
really?
The tree lot, it's, you can see a TTC streetcar going by in the background when the old, like two, old ones, and they were still on the street at that time. And one scene in the Chinese restaurants on Cherry Beach.
No way.
And there's scenes where you can see like firefighters in the distance, like dealing with snow and stuff. But yeah, so it's like, and it's like a Genie nominated film because it was essentially a Canadian film.
Wow.
So it's,
I had no idea.
Good pick.
I know. It's just like something feels right about this.
Got her CanCon in.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I just, it's, it, that's one that we watch probably at least twice every Christmas.
Yeah. I feel like it really, it does, of any Christmas movie, I feel like it actually gets me feeling Christmassy, even though the older I get, the more grinchier I get. No pun intended.
He's turning green.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got a tinge of green.
That's it. I'm starting to speak in rhyme. Yeah, it's such a nice movie. And then like, what's like so relatable about it? At least like for me, I feel like for me, like growing up as a kid, is like he has like all these like fantastical, like imagination of like how scenarios are gonna go down, whether it's he is going to get an A+ on a test and then get put on his classmates' shoulders and carried around like a hero. Or if, you know, his dad's coming home and he's going to like basically like beat the crap out of him type thing. And you're just like, your imagination just like runs like to the extremes every time when you're a kid.
It is grounded, but fantastical. Like it's a grounded version of how a kid views reality in a way. Like they don't really understand the swear words their parents are saying, like when the old man loses, he's like in the furnace room. but then at the tire change scene,
so good.
And they make it deliberately, it's still understandable, close enough to a swear that you know what he said.
Yeah, you pretty much, I mean, you start laughing anyway, so you pretty much just assume that's what he says.
Yeah. And that entire meltdown of him just terrified.
Yeah.
And his blaming his friend and his brother, like, just like, oh no! Oh no!
Yeah. And then one of my favorite, like one of his like visions or imaginations is like when he pretends, or like he's thinking that he has gone blind.
Yes.
And he's homeless, and he comes back in to their house and he's like, it was so poisoning.
Yeah, the childhood vengeance cycle. Like, children are little psychopaths. Exactly. It's like they don't
I'll
have
show
the...
you. So good. Yeah.
And one of my other favorite scenes. And the thing I love about that is like almost every scene can stand on its own.
Definitely.
Like if you took it out, it could be a sketch.
Yeah.
Just on its own. So it's like, but it's interconnected. It moves forward. But every moment is precious in that film, which is just astounding.
Yeah.
But yeah, like my favorite, the fight when Scott Farkas, when he finally breaks.
Yes.
Because that's how, like, bullies.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're not, the only thing between a bully and a victim of a bully is a kid snapping.
Yes.
And when he snaps and beats the crap out of and his brother is like hiding under the sink because he's afraid he's going to get in trouble. And the mom just like glosses it over.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, this is kind of sweet.
Yeah. And I can never get over how well they cast that bully. Like that kid is so punchable looking.
Yes.
Like he looks like such an asshole and he's got like beady little eyes and like the old school shitty braces.
Yes. And his like sidekick.
Yeah.
In like the leather jacket and the paperboy hat kind of thing.
Who's like a 12-year-old like Joe Pesci.
Yes.
Basically.
Like, oh yeah, get away. You know? Yeah. They capture the dynamic of childhood just perfectly. And it's funny because it doesn't glaze over the commercialism of it. Like that Christmas morning, nobody's taking care. Everybody's just like tearing into those packages.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it doesn't feel gross because at the core of that, there's still this love between all of these characters. Even if they're like, you know, Randy's passed out on the floor hugging his Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. They're still like, oh, there's some love there.
Yeah.
What are some moments from the film that stand out?
The biggest one for me is the fight, is the snapping. Like I had a similar scenario. So like, for whatever reason, I don't know. It was like me and a couple of friends were like trying to, like, this is very classic, like actually trying to do like a lemonade stand when we were like, like in grade, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 or something, on the streets of Halifax, Nova Scotia. And these like other kids in the neighborhood kept like fucking around with our setup before we could even like get set up.
Mm-hmm.
So I like got like a little like bowl with like soap in it to like wash the stuff, and I brought it out, and I went in and I got like glasses, and when I came out, like the soap bowl was like flipped over.
Aww.
And I was like,
so sad.
I was like, god damn it. And so I got like mixed lemonade, like brought it out, and like one of the glasses is missing, and I snapped. Like they were not in sight. They're very sneaky and effective, but I like snapped, and I just, every swear word I knew just like came out like at the top of my lungs. Like people are just like poking out of their windows and just being like, what the hell? I'm like, fucking son of a bitch, blah, blah. Freaking out. So like when he's punching the kid in the movie and he's like, blah, 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 like just swearing every word that he can actually think of. I was like, yeah, I know what that feels like.
And the funny thing about that too is like, it's almost like the swears are the bigger concern for the family. Like the brother's more, he was swearing. Like, that's what's freaked him up more than the violence.
The kids are like on the side of the fence and like, what did he say?
like Flick brings the mom. And he's like, oh no.
Yeah.
Do you have any moments in that movie that stand out to you, Emily?
This is the movie with the leg lamp, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
Yeah.
Fragile.
It's Italian.
Fragile. That's all I remember.
For me, it was, I think, the Little Orphan Annie decoder ring, because that's like the end of innocence for that character. Ralphie's like, oh, it's all a fucking lie.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's sort of a pivot point in the film for his character in a way, too.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, no.
Yeah, it's like, this is
it's all bullshit.
This is commercial bullshit.
Make me drink Ovaltine.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Annie.
Yeah. Fuck you, Annie. It's true.
Yeah.
Other orphans.
Yeah. I
they're the worst.
It's such an amazing film. Yeah, and I mean, it's shoestring budget, $3.3 million.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those films like Blade Runner, did okay, better than Blade Runner in the box office, $20.2 million or $20.3 million. And box office returns at 83, which is pretty good. And this is just with a, you know, $3.3 million budget. It's probably about a $15 million budget in today's film standards. But Turner bought up the rights to a bunch of that were under the MGM title and just threw it on Turner Classic Movies and revitalized this film.
Yeah.
Like, it just got in front of all these people who probably would have never seen it otherwise.
Yeah.
It's like, it's amazing.
Was Turner Classic Movies a free channel? Was it a free channel for a while?
I think it was basic cable for a long time.
Yeah.
So if you had like probably basic like, cable, yeah, you'd get it.
Maybe that was the part of the
over and over and over.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it was on once a day.
Yeah. You know, like The Mummy.
The Mummy. Yeah.
Oh my God. I love that movie. Or the original Jumanji. But that's that's another podcast probably.
Okay. So my Christmas special that I chose was A Colbert Christmas, The Greatest Gift of All.
Colbert Christmas, The Greatest Gift of All, was released in 2008 as a Comedy Central special featuring Stephen Colbert, the star of their news satire show, The Colbert Report, and former correspondent of The Daily Show. Colbert had left The Daily Show in 2005 and spun off into his own series, also produced by Jon Stewart, called The Colbert Report, which some feel eclipsed The Daily Show by leaning into the absurdity of Stephen Colbert's fictional, hyper-conservative version of Stephen Colbert. A graduate of Northwestern's University School of Communications, he found a love of theater while attending Northwestern and threw himself into the field, eventually resulting in a theater nerd-off with Aaron Sorkin on The Colbert Report. Originally studying to become a dramatic actor, he fell into improv, as many of us do. Starting in the campus improv team No Fun Mud Piranhas, he soon joined Chicago's Annoyance Theater, a part of Del Close's Improv Olympics. Annoyance Theater relied heavily on absurdist and outrageous comedy, an influence clearly seen in the character of Stephen Colbert as played by Stephen Colbert. He eventually joined Second City, despite a rivalry between Annoyance Theater and Second City, and given the opportunity for free classes, shot through the ranks, joining the touring company as Steve Carell's understudy, and forming a collaborative unit with Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello, with whom he collaborated to create Strangers with Candy. By 2008, the character of Stephen Colbert was firmly established. A blowhard parody of Bill O'Reilly and other Fox News personalities, the character was so sharp at times people couldn't tell if it was a joke, including Bill O'Reilly. This led to some rather hilarious and possibly embarrassing moments, including a White House correspondence dinner where Stephen went to town on the president, George W. Bush. Running from 2005 to 2014, The Colbert Report hit peak hype very quickly, in no small part thanks to Stephen Colbert's incredible stage presence. But his love of pop culture, stage, and song led to a hilarious send-up of vintage Christmas specials, Commercialism and The War on Christmas, starring Elvis Costello, Toby Keith, John Legend, Willie Nelson, and John Stewart, all as slightly fictionalized versions of themselves. While Feist appears as an angel and George Wendt as Santa in the special, it is packed with songs by David Haverbaum and Emmy, Grammy, and ASCAP Pop Music Award winner Adam Schlesinger, and performed by nearly all the cast. Aired on November 23, 2008, the special was immediately released as a DVD, with 20 minutes of extra footage, as well as a video advent calendar. Sadly, the commercial parody, Buff Your Jingle Bells, was only on the broadcast version and is lost to those of us who only saw it on DVD. The special was well received critically, and its soundtrack was released on iTunes, and was eventually used as part of a prank played by Colbert on Kanye West. December 3rd, 2008, Operation Humble Kanye started when Colbert asked his audience to download his album and make him the voice of this generation of this decade, in response to Kanye's self-proclamation that he owned that title. It briefly worked, displacing Kanye as number one on the charts until Colbert declared Kanye officially humbled on December 4th. If only Stephen had kept making music, perhaps this would have allowed Kanye a moment of self-reflection.
And why this ended up on my list is it's possibly the most realized satire of Christmas specials ever. Because, I mean, Colbert, Stephen Colbert is, like, you know, came up through Northwestern University as a theater student. He's like very aware of pop culture and stuff. And he just, it's a pure send up of everything in America, right? And like it starts with this song by Toby Keith about a war on Christmas, where Toby Keith is, you know, probably would just sing that in a completely unironic way.
Right.
But it's like so over the top, and so like this footage from like Santa Claus versus the Martians, all of these like old cheesy movies mixed with like Vietnam War footage. Oh, it's just this total fuck you to like that hyper partisan bullshit that was going on at the time in like late Bush era,
right,
kind of stuff, right before Obama came into power. And it was over the, and you had like amazing music. Like, it's all original music by, can't remember the composers, but it's in my intro, but they are, like Grammy Award-winning, Tony Award-winning composers, and pretty much everybody except for George Wendt, and that's it. Like, George Wendt is the only person who doesn't sing a song, but you've got Elvis Costello, you've got Feist at her peak, John Legend, while he was sort of up and coming.
Let's get to the book burning portion of this on the DVD special features.
Oh
yes, yes.
Did you ever watch them?
Yes, I did. And I mean, again, that's it's. but yeah, so you got George, but you got these great songs and the special features, which yes. You know, this is sort of unique in that it literally has an ad for the special you're watching in the special, with 20 minutes of extra features and a DVD digital advent calendar. And part of that being book burning, which again is a...
They burn books that are like storybooks of bears.
Yeah, because...
He doesn't like bears.
Colbert, the big villain in this is a bear who keeps him in the in his cabin, so right. He can't get away and go to the special. It's just like this... It's
great. I have a very fond memory of watching that on loop. Like, you know, like Log was such a big thing.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. It's like Log, and they just like...
Yeah.
Bear books into yes. it. Yeah. So my brother got it for Christmas and he left it on all Christmas day, and the grandparents kept looking over like, what are we watching? And it's only like a 10-minute segment, so it's like looping the exact right. same thing over and over
yeah.
again.
Yeah.
It was entertaining, to say the least.
Yeah. And again, and that's what I love about it. It's just like last year I brought up this British parody satire ADBC. That was my favorite last year, which is a parody of the very sort of British concept of like the musical and like Jesus Christ Superstar and that sort of, but this was a satire of a moment in time that was both historic and contemporary. So it kind of brought them all together, making fun of like, you know, and Colbert is a devout Catholic.
Yeah.
Like he's a progressive Catholic, but it is a big part of his upbringing and his personality. And he is a person of faith, and he is not ashamed or afraid to poke fun at the ridiculous elements. And like him and Jon Stewart doing the duet about like, you know, about Hanukkah, which is possibly my favorite. I mean, there's a lot of good, like Elvis Costello's duet with him at the very end is like just actually heart-wrenching when you listen to the lyrics. It's not my favorite. My favorite song is A Thing Called Hanukkah. And it's, you know, we got pancakes, or we got latkes. What are they? Potato pancakes. It's just the entire dynamic of, you know, Jon Stewart sort of like self putting himself down, but in a funny kind of way. And then the ignorance and sort of like complete like mindlessness of Colbert's character, of Stephen Colbert, is brilliant. So it's just it's one of those ones that I go back to every year.
I did watch it last year under direction of my brother, so I think he's on the same page as you. It's an annual treat.
Yes,
for indeed. Sure.
And every year I get to watch Feist get her balls. So that's, you know, another one. Whenever a bell falls, or whatever. What was it? Whenever a bell falls, an angel gets its balls, or something like
whenever
that.
Whenever a bell rings, an angel.
Maybe
because
it's a play
like,
on the,
whenever a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
Yeah, it's a play on. I think it's on falls balls is the rhyme there.
Cool.
This is when something drops.
Sounds about right.
And like, and you know, Willie Nelson.
Yeah.
It's so, it's just like complete, it's like a 4 minute pot joke.
Yeah.
Like just like, pot and taxes, because he's broke because he didn't pay his taxes that year and was like arrested. And it's like, oh, they're all making fun of themselves. And John Legend's song is kind of sexy, you know, and like not even a veiled double entendre, like nutmeg, you know, right. Only cream I want to see you wipe off your face is my nutmeg. I mean, like, that's an entendre. Yeah. You know, it's not a double, it's just like, here you go, have fun. And all of the, like, so there's, it's, you know, I don't think we'd get something like that. Comedy Central did a special a couple of years later, which was okay. It had like Kroll Show and a bunch of the other stuff at the time, but it didn't seem to have that kind of subversiveness that you see here. It was gross out humor. It was like over the top silliness, but just not quite the same.
Well, we can only have our nostalgic things that really make us feel like it's Christmas time. Right?
Exactly.
Right, that's it.
All right, well, I want to thank you both for coming on, and you know, hopefully we'll have you back sometime in the future to talk about more comedy stuff.
Really?
For sure, thanks for having us.
Thanks. Bye.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.